News Radio 560 KPQ.
This is The Agenda from News Radio 560 KPQ and KPQ.com, where topics of local concern affecting you are open for discussion. And now your host, Michael Knight.
Here we go. It's a Monday edition. It's 12:15. Time for The Agenda. Good afternoon to you. Sunny day outside. Temperatures in the upper 50s. And I ask you to consider this. Guns. Now I got your attention. Guns make people crazy. In our mind, we think someone is going to take our gun. Someone is finagling a way to prevent you from buying a gun. Someone somewhere is first planning to take your gun and then threaten your undefended family with their gun. But we've come to a couple of conclusions. People are not the problem. Guns are not the problem. National gun organizations are not the problem. Gun victims are not the problem. Gun activists are not the problem. Gun safety, not the problem. Gun laws are not the problem. Gun manufacturers, not the problem. Handguns, not the problem. Long guns, semi-automatic weapons, not the problem. The insane, the mentally disturbed, well, they're not the problem. The dead are not the problem. The mentally disturbed, no. The wounded, no. The police, they're not the problem. Survivalists, no, not the problem. Sportsmen are not the problem. The past is not the problem. And the future is so bright, there's no problem in America, none whatsoever. What is the problem? Well, we do not appear to have problems, really. We just have divergent points of view that are, at the same identical time, correct, justified, acceptable, thoughtful, well-meaning, true to our beliefs and traditions. They are virtuous, they're moral, they're ethical, they're reasonable, they're accurate, they're exact and precise, and we can't figure out why the other side won't believe with us. It's what God wants more than a birthday cake, and now that everyone is true and honest and alert, it is a comfort to realize that at this late date, everyone gets to voice their opinion, and everyone can feel comfort in knowing that they are right about this matter of future gun safety in Washington, as theoretically addressed by the State Initiative 1639. So, you tell me what is right. First, realize that everyone being right at the very same time, that is unlikely. It is what we believe, such as the unforgiving law of probability, it just can't be. I wish it was true. Oh, I do. But we cannot all be right, and that, as frustrating as it seems, is a good place to start. Let's examine how right we are. We'll be back to discuss this right after these words.
Critical. Make a difference today by calling us at 509-682-1111 or email me direct at russ@frontlinerealestate.com.
News Radio 560 KPQ, I'm Michael Knight. This is The Agenda. My special guest is Steve Paolini. He's speaking about Yes on 1639. If you're a little confused about all the agendas going, all the initiatives going on around the area, that's why The Agenda is broadcasting this program. The Yes on 1639 vote will cause us to do what, Steve Paolini?
Hey, thanks for having me on.
You're very welcome.
Initiative 1639 is a gun violence prevention measure, and the main thrust of it is something that, while I've got the chance to go all across the state of Washington and talk to voters, most folks are, more confused that this isn't already the case. And that's to say that it should be at least as hard to purchase a semi-automatic assault rifle like an AR-15 as it already is to purchase a handgun like a revolver. And right now in the state of Washington, you've got to be 21 years old, wait up to 5 days, and go through a more advanced local law enforcement background check to purchase a revolver, but none of that is required to purchase an AR-15. Over here on 1639, we think that's absurd, and so that's the main thrust of the initiative.
And the initiative also raises the age to buy a semi-automatic weapon?
That's right. So it would raise the age to purchase a semi-automatic assault rifle from 18 to 21 to what's already required for handguns. It would require up to a 10-day waiting period, and it would enforce that local law enforcement background check that's already required for handguns as well.
How do local law enforcement do that background check? Seems like they have a lot of work to do to make that happen within the 10-day window of possibility.
Yeah, so the local law enforcement actually already run these background checks, and they do so within the first 5 days. This would, by creating the waiting period of up to 10 days, we actually give them even more time to run those background checks. That's something that 1639 does that sort of helps to lessen the burden placed on our local law enforcement. The real difference, however, is about which records are checked. And so right now we have a federal database, that's the NICS database. It's a more quick check. And it can sometimes lose some of the most up-to-date local law enforcement records. So if you had a recent domestic violence conviction, if you had a recent extreme risk protection order or domestic violence protection order, or a recent reason that you were prohibited from purchasing a firearm, there can sometimes be a delay. And so making sure that we check the most up-to-date local law enforcement record rather than just that federal record helps to make sure that those kinds of purchases don't slip through the cracks.
There's also a firearm safety training course that has to be completed within 5 years of purchase, I take it?
Yeah, so when purchasing a semi-automatic assault rifle, you would have to show proof of taking a basic training course within the last 5 years. And that's just for semi-automatic assault rifles in 1639.
Let's take a look how Yes on 1639 would help reduce gun violence that we've had so much of in the last couple of years, especially school violence.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm 22 years old, and in my very short lifetime, over 200,000 students have already been impacted by school shootings. And I think that's a number that's really unique to the United States of America, and it's unique to a country that has very unfettered access to firearms. And so a couple of the provisions in here, if you look at other states that already have them, you see pretty significant reductions. So with just the waiting periods and the local background checks, for example, we see a 17% reduction in homicides. We see a 10% reduction in suicides. In addition, 1639 has a kind of safe storage accountability requirement, and in states with those kinds of laws, we see 24% less accidental shootings with children. And so what we're really taking a look at here is with semi-automatic assault rifles. This is a category of firearm that, when used in crimes, results in 80% more injuries and 60% more fatalities. These are more deadly, more lethal firearms. And so regulating them and making sure that for example, with that age requirement, if you look at Parkland's really big shooting that a lot of people are focusing on, that was a 19-year-old kid that gained access to a firearm owned by his parents. Under Initiative 1639, not only would he be not able to purchase the kind of firearm that he used in that crime, but if he was able to gain access to it from his parents could actually face accountability because of that.
So whoever owns the gun is responsible for how it's used.
Well, they're responsible for storing it properly, which is to say I'm a gun owner, right, and I store firearms in my home with a trigger lock. And under Initiative 1639, I would need to do what is a reasonable expectation to keep my firearm out of the hands of a child, out of easy access to a child or another prohibited person. So that's really the standard of accountability.
As a gun owner, how would this change the way you store, study the gun safety laws, and purchase your weapons?
It wouldn't change the way I currently store my firearm. Under Initiative 1639, keeping your firearm locked with a trigger lock is sufficient accountability. In addition, you know, it wouldn't change much actually about the way that I purchase firearms either, because again, a lot of these things, or almost all of them, are already required for handguns. So there's not a huge difference really. The way I take a look at this initiative is it's really about essentially closing a loophole. We have semi-automatic handguns in which we enforce a number of regulations due to their increased lethality, but then we have a segment of semi-automatic rifles that we don't apply that to. And that is really a loophole, if anything. And so we're trying to close that and really put them into the same category. If it's semi-automatic, then it's gonna have this level of regulation.
This initiative doesn't seem that draconian, but some people are describing it as the most serious gun safety law that's ostensibly on the books in the United States. Is that true?
No, it's not at all the most serious or comprehensive in the United States. I would say it's one of the more comprehensive policies put forward in Washington State. And, you know, when combined with the laws that are already on the books, it would certainly put Washington within, you know, the top five safest from gun violence states in the country. But as, you know, California clearly, Massachusetts clearly, Connecticut clearly have more serious gun laws and laws I think that are actually designed worse. You know, with our main ethos when putting together this kind of policy was really, how do we balance rights with responsibilities? How do we design a set of laws that keep us safe but don't infringe on the average responsible gun owner? And all the stuff that's in Initiative 1639, if you are a responsible gun owner, it will not affect you one bit.
How was the initiative written and who had input?
Yeah, so every component of the initiative was actually in the legislature at one point. The main thrust here, the raising the age from 18 to 21, was a bill that was actually put forward by the Attorney General in Washington State over the last 4 years, and it was killed in committee the day of the Parkland shooting. And so this is a policy that we knew it was not you know, rejected because of its content or because of, you know, how well it was written. It was rejected because of political reasons. It was rejected because some of our legislators have a kind of cowardice around gun violence prevention issues that they don't on other issues. And so we took that piece of the policy and we combined it as well with a policy, the safe storage component that I mentioned. That had been introduced first in the legislature in 1999. So I was 3 years old when it was first introduced. And it's a great piece of policy. That really is rooted in actually the best available data to prevent gun violence. It's probably the piece of this policy in 1639 that will prevent the most gun violence by keeping guns out of the hands of dangerous individuals. And so each of these pieces of policy were things that we had actually had decades of time working with in the legislature, really refining them to be extremely well-written, extremely concise policies. And then we wanted to say, listen, the initiative process is a way for the people to say, you know, our legislature is not in line with where we are on this issue.
Who's backing you and who's against you?
Yeah, I mean, we have thousands of supporters that have worked day and night to get this initiative on the ballot. It's a coalition of faith groups and education organizations and law enforcement. And it's a really wide-ranging and broad coalition of supporters. On the other side, it's the traditional, you know, opponents of basically every gun safety and gun violence prevention measure ever put forward in the state, and that's the National Rifle Association, that's the Second Amendment Foundation, that's the Washington Arms Collectors. They have opposed literally everything that we have ever put forward in the legislature without suggesting a solution of their own ever at any point in the legislature either.
It's traditional in American politics when an initiative gets on the ballot. Sometimes it's difficult to know if you're voting yes and getting a yes, or you can be voting yes and actually getting a no. And the advertisement doesn't always make it easier for you. How do you think the advertisement and the media slant on this one has been?
Yeah, well, this is a good example of an initiative where you know exactly what you're voting for, right? Yes increases the regulations, no keeps things as they are.
Is law enforcement behind this idea?
Yeah, so we have the support. We're the first initiative that the Attorney General's office has ever endorsed. We have many county prosecutors and sheriffs. There are a few law enforcement organizations on the opposition side that have opposed us as well. So I would say it's in the benefit of fairness, I think it's probably equal.
Let's talk about a scenario that's similar to some of the school shootings we've had. An emotionally disturbed 17, 18, or 19-year-old manages to get a gun. Maybe he purchases it. Maybe he uses his parents. He has the ability to shoot up his school and cause a lot of death and destruction and sorrow. How would this change that scenario?
Yeah, absolutely. So we can actually look at examples of mass shootings that have occurred recently. There was a shooting up in Mukilteo. The citizen sponsor of Initiative 1639 was the father of a kid that was actually shot in the back at an innocent house party in which a disgruntled, recently rejected 19-year-old boy decided to kill his girlfriend and two of her friends at a house party. And, you know, he was 19 years old. He went into a Cabela's. He purchased an AR-15. And a day later, he was able to use it to kill three people and injure others. And so what this initiative would do is it, first of all, would say if you're, you know, in that period of time where we know that brain development is less developed, but we know that you're in a more dangerous sort of situation, you're not going to be able to purchase the most deadly firearms available to residents in the state of Washington. You're not going to be able to purchase an AR-15. In addition, you know, even if you were 21 years old, you'd have to wait up to 10 days. And that can really help to make sure in the case of suicides or in the case of somebody that's currently in a really traumatized or at-risk situation that they have to wait before they're able to purchase, again, the most deadly kinds of firearms available. In addition, you know, if you look at a lot of these mass shootings, These are individuals that are gaining access to firearms from law-abiding gun owners that have left their firearms really in a negligent and irresponsible way. You know, they've left their gun loaded and unsecured on the countertop, you know, and a kid takes it and brings it, you know, in his backpack. And there was a case where he dropped, you know, a kid dropped the bag and it fired and injured two of his friends. You know, these are firearms that are stored not under lock and key and not even in, you know, a locked cabinet. They're left just sort of very irresponsibly out for anybody to gain access to them. And so that's at the heart of a number of mass shootings. And so the Initiative 1639 will really put the impetus back on the gun owner and say, your actions have consequences. If you're going to be negligent and irresponsible, you're going to be able to face accountability because of that.
Do you have any idea in terms of polls how the initiative is going, yay or nay?
Yeah, there was an Elway poll a couple of weeks ago that had us at 59% with 7% undecided.
And do you think that's accurate?
Yeah, I think that's well within where we can land. You know, what we know from our own internal research is that if we get the message out to voters about what this policy is, you know, again, what we're asking voters for is let's make sure that a class of firearms that either deadlier, more lethal firearms that contribute to 80% more injuries, 60% more deaths when they're used in crimes. Let's make sure that they are at least as difficult to purchase as what is already required for handguns. If folks understand that message, they overwhelmingly support it. So if we're able to get our message out, if we're able to cut through the misinformation, of which there is a lot because our opponent is the NRA, then folks will support it and they'll do it overwhelmingly. Our challenge, of course, in the next, you know, 15 days or so here is really to make sure that we're able to do that. You know, the NRA has started placing a bunch of advertisements that are really fear-mongering and confusing to voters. And so, you know, if we're able to fight back against that, I know that we can reach what the Elway poll has us at or better.
Steve, thanks for being with us today. I appreciate your time and for putting yes on 1639 into focus. Steve Paolini, thank you so much
for
being on the agenda. I appreciate your time.
All right. Bye.
News Radio 560 KPQ.
Where it's 12:32 in the afternoon, I'm Michael Knight. I'm the one who books all these shows. Just want you to know we reached out to the vote no on I-1639 and through their website, which is the only way to contact them, unfortunately. You don't really get to speak to a person. You just send in an email and hope you get a response. To date, we have not. But if you take a look at the no on 1639 website, it says, don't criminalize self-defense. Help defeat Initiative 1639. It is a flawed and misguided gun control ballot initiative that will take away your Second Amendment rights without reducing violent crime in Washington State. Once again, we've reached out to all the people pro and con on all the initiatives and have not received word back from most of them, to tell you the truth, which is sort of surprising. Candidates respond in one way, but people behind initiatives often are organizations and out of state. I'm not saying that's the case in this particular instance, but for the people who say vote no on 1639, I offered them equal time. And to date, they have not responded.
Initiative 1634 is really very simple. Voting yes on 1634 will prohibit local growth.
That's 886-4600.
Taylor Mortgage, home loans tailor-made for you.
News Radio 560 KPQ, I'm Michael Knight. My very special guest in the agenda is the Honorable Jay Inslee, Governor of the great state of Washington. Wonderful to have you in the studio today, Governor.
Well, what a day. Best day of the year in Wenatchee. What an incredible day.
And an important day for us to have a special guest. But what brought you to Wenatchee? That's where we should start.
We are looking at the mental health systems here. We've got to make improvements in our mental health system statewide, and there's some really creative things going on here in the valley that we want to look at. We went to Parkside and looked at the new facility there, talked about some new options, went to Confluence and looked at what they call MU1, it's a mental health facility inside the hospital with 10 beds there. And then we met with the mental health community from up and down the area. We had folks from Colville, from Okanagan, to really look about how we build a new mental health care delivery system. We know we have more challenges every year. And we know we need to have a more community-based system. We need to provide mental health services to people where they live rather than having them have to go to big hospitals away from their communities. So this year we're very optimistic and eager to start reforming our mental health care system. And I got some great ideas today in Wenatchee. It's been a great trip.
When people fall through the nets that society provides for them in terms of mental health, bad things begin to happen to the community as well as to the individual.
Well, we know that mental health is involved in our homelessness crisis. A very significant percentage of our homeless people have untreated and undertreated mental health problems, and obviously addictive problems is part of that as well. So this is wrapped into much of the problems we have, and it's universal. You know, this strikes every family in some way. Everyone has some experience with the challenges of mental health. And so it's something that ought to be universal in our efforts to improve that system. And frankly, we've had an antiquated system. It's been based on very large hospitals in very old hospitals built in 1890. We need to really bring our mental health system up to speed in this century. And this century's model is to provide mental health where people live. So it's close to their family, close to their church, close to where they work, close to their school. And you get better results for people when you do that. And by the way, you do get good results. One of the great myths about mental health is sort of people think they don't recover. You know, we just get tremendous results when people get good treatment. So I'm excited about what we learned today, which is to try to find a way to provide more mental health professionals. We've got to widen that pipeline, find a way to provide the right system so that the person gets what they need. Not just fit them in some box. It doesn't fit what their real need is. We also need to build a system to deal with dementia issues, because we know it's going to be more frequent as our population ages. So I got some really good ideas today, and I'm looking forward to the next session of the legislature really making some changes.
It's an expensive proposition, offering mental health to those who need it the most, and sometimes having to seek them out and bring them into treatment. Is the state of Washington prepared financially to be able to do this?
Well, not today, because unfortunately we have about $1.5 billion deficit in our federal budget going into next year, even to just keep existing operations for our schools and police and everything else. So we're going to have to make some hard decisions to figure out how to finance this. But I do believe there's a good start on a bipartisan basis. There appears to be some bipartisan consensus that we need to move in this direction to provide services in a community-based setting. And I think there's broad agreement on the legislature to do that in both parties. So that's a good starting place. But we will have to find a way to finance it, because the state, and this is one of the great ironies, we have the best economy in the United States. The economy is booming. Job creation is robust. But we have a system that just does not generate revenues adequate to the needs of providing schools and mental health and parks and everything else. So legislators are going to have a challenge, and they're going to need to step up to the plate.
All the cities on the West Coast have the same sort of challenge. Their corporations are leading the way into the future. But on the sidewalks of those cities, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Seattle, there's a population that is being ignored to the level where human excrement on the sidewalks is now the number one problem in San Francisco, my old hometown, which people can't believe it actually exists, that we're dealing with this kind of problem. And I know there's not an easy solution for it, but it must bother you on a daily basis just to drive through Seattle and see those who have been left behind.
Well, it's not just Seattle. This really is a statewide problem, and it's a byproduct of a successful economy. It's one of the great ironies of life that when you have a huge influx of people, as we have to the state of Washington, particularly in the western side, we have 65,000 people moving to the state, and we're not building 65,000 housing units. Well, as a result, rents are going up. People are bidding for their rents, and rents go up. And every time rents go up $100 a month, homelessness goes up dramatically. It's almost a linear progression of homelessness. So it is, you mentioned San Francisco, the hottest economies have the most growth of this homelessness population, because we're not building enough housing. We don't have a way to keep rent stable. And as a result, we have more people falling into the homelessness situation. So there are many things we need to do to solve this problem. We have to have a more robust mental health care system, because we know a lot of homelessness people have those challenges. We have to have a better wraparound services to give people job training to get them back in the job market. We have to have more access and more successful addictive and chemical dependency programs. And fundamentally, we have to build more housing. Look, if you have 65,000 people coming to our state, we should celebrate that, because it's a great economy. But we have to build more housing fundamentally to get ahead of this curve. And so we're talking about ways to do that. Now, obviously, in the short term, we have increased our support to build low-income housing dramatically in the hundreds of millions of dollars in the last several years. And we'll make additional investments this year. But we have to make it so that the private sector can be involved in that construction as well.
Can this subject that we're talking about turn into a bipartisan solution, or is Washington capable of such a thing?
No, it is. We are capable of bipartisanship. We've had some real bipartisan steps forward. We financed the largest infrastructure, transportation infrastructure package in the history of the state. We're now building $70 billion of transportation infrastructure virtually in every county of the state. And that was done on a bipartisan basis, and I'm glad that we got that done. You know, Washington, D.C. can't build a birdhouse right now. And we're building $70 billion because we're optimistic about our state, and it was a bipartisan success. I'm happy that we got parties to work together to get that done. We had a similar bipartisan success to finance our schools. As you know, we finally are financing our K through 12 system according to the constitutional mandates, and that was a bipartisan effort. There had to be a lot of compromise. There had a lot of a consensus. And that got done on a bipartisan basis. We're not done on that. There's more work to do in our schools as well. And I'm very active in trying to promote our early child education. So there's more work to be done. But on mental health and homelessness, yes, I hope there will be. And as I've indicated, there's been a good start on bipartisanship, particularly in mental health. Both Republicans and Democrat leadership have been singing the tune I have that we need to reform our system. It has to be more community-based. We have to build the pipeline of talent, so we have the therapists and the psychiatrists, and we have to finance it. Now, that's the place that becomes more difficult because it's easier to reform and it's more difficult to actually pay for these things. So there will be a discussion about that, and I hope there's a bipartisan solution to it.
Last time you were here, you were talking about broadband for the more rural areas and the schools and the children and of the certain generation that are being not left behind, but certainly cut short in terms of their access to the World Wide Web.
Yeah, this is fundamental to our children for educational purposes, and it's fundamental to our business people for economic growth, because we know that if you want to have access to the world's markets, you've got to have broadband access. And this is important in every neighborhood and small town in the state of Washington. So we have been active looking for every option to extend broadband. I'm pleased that we've been able to expand the number of entities that can provide it, of ports and PUDs, and we're looking for new ideas on how to finance those last miles, if you will. So we've seen some success. I did a tour 2 months ago about the broadband in the state of Washington, and we're really looking for any way to allow communities to get this done. It is also a health and safety issue. We have communities now that are threatened by rising sea levels and climate change and tsunamis, and this is a health and safety issue as well.
When you look at the recent changes in the death penalty just this week, this is something that societies around the world have abandoned a long time ago, but we've been executing people since we've been walking erect. Is it time to leave the death penalty behind, and is it something that the public wants?
Well, I think there's divergent views on this. I think there are passionate views on both sides of this issue. As you know, I put a moratorium on the death penalty while I'm governor. And I do believe the Supreme Court's decision yesterday was a correct one, because they basically concluded that the death penalty was wildly discriminatory and unfair and unequal in its application. The evidence was clear that for the same crime, an African-American person gets one penalty, and frequently a Caucasian person got another. And that's just unacceptable in a society that demands equal justice. It's also grossly unfair because between different counties, for the same crime, if you're on one side of the Columbia River, you get one crime, and if you're in the other, or one punishment, you get a different. It's just untenable to have a system that is so unequal. So there are widely divergent philosophical views about the death penalty, but the one thing that I have found that there is a union and unity on is the concept that it should be equal, it should be fair, we should give the same punishment for the same crime. And on that, we're not doing that. The system does not do that, and so that the Supreme Court ruled it's unconstitutional. So I agree with that decision. I think it's the right one. It's consistent with my moratorium. And now we can tell people that for a certainty, when a person is convicted, they're going to die in prison. They're going to be in prison for the rest of their natural life. They are going to die in prison. And so that is a final judgment. We now know what the law is, and we need to move forward.
We're just days away from the midterm elections. It promises to be a surprising election for some people. Can you handicap what you see happening so far in the West and across the world?
Well, you know, if I could, I'd be a billionaire having projected all the future, so I don't have an entire crystal ball. I would say that there is clearly concern in the entire nation about some of the chaos emanating from Washington, D.C. There is a concern in the entire nation that we should be trying to unite the nation rather than trying to divide it. There is a thirst for union rather than disunion. There is a thirst for a voice who will appeal to people's better angels rather than anger and division and hatred. And, you know, if that thirst, I think, is going to be answered by a lot of new people in offices, that would be my prediction. And I suspect a lot of them are going to be wearing the blue jersey. So that's my immediate thought. You know which side I would prefer that to be on. And I think the country is looking for some changes in that regard.
Given this, the atmosphere around the political life right now, would you consider running for higher office, Governor?
Well, I'm not saying no to anything right now. I'm saying yes to encouraging people to vote. Whoever you're going to vote for, whichever party you want to support, I encourage everyone to vote. That's my number one goal right now. The country will do better when everyone votes. So it doesn't matter who you're going to vote for. I would encourage you to get out and vote. We've made it easier because the Republican Secretary of State, Kim Ryman, and the Democratic governor have both dipped into our budgets to buy a stamp for everyone. So we've tried to make it easier for both Republicans and Democrats to vote this year, and I hope that will happen. And I'm proud of our state because unlike a lot of states, we're making it easier for people to vote rather than suppressing the vote. And this is a very vile and concerning thing that in many states there's been a outright effort to suppress the ability to vote. We've seen in Georgia where they wanted to close down the voting places in African-American counties. We've seen in Ohio where they forced people to wait for 2 and 3 hours in line in the minority community to vote. We have taken the opposite approach. We've actually passed the best voting rights laws in the nation in the last legislative session with same-day voter, motor voter registration, the Voting Rights Act. And we ought to be proud that we want everybody to vote, no matter who you vote for. And I'm encouraging people to do that.
And with that level of effort, does it drive you crazy when 40% turns out, as it does me?
Well, not enough people listen to your radio show.
That could be the problem.
We need more people. That's the solution to most of society's ills. It does, frankly, because we need voices. I mean, the more voices that participate, the smarter the decisions that we make as a community. And so, yes, that's why we've tried to make it as easy as possible to vote. We have fought voter suppression, and we've tried to get around and talk to as many people as we can. So it is improved over time because of some of the things we've done, and we want to continue to increase that.
That's the governor of Washington, Governor Jay Inslee, who stopped by KPQ on the 12th of October. Couldn't play it back until today because we had so many candidates on the air, and that's really a good problem to have. 551 at News Radio 560 KPQ. You're listening to The Agenda.
My name is Ruth Esparza.